The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's worldview and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. A dramatic increase in the sale of modern weapons has made the Middle East the most militarized region in the world. The Holy Land, the ancient Bible lands of the world, the Middle East, should be the focal point of world attention. For many years on this program, even during the worst and the darkest days of American involvement in Vietnam, I was saying repeatedly the time is going to come when headlines out of the Middle East and Europe are going to pale into insignificance American concern over Vietnam. Well, little realized today, even though there is not at the moment, as I speak at least, and that could change by the time I finish speaking or by the time you get around to hearing the news broadcast, I suppose, because that's how volatile, how unpredictable the Middle Eastern region is. But in spite of its turmoil and back and forth and up and down of the ceasefires and the breaking or the interruption of those ceasefires in Lebanon, formerly one of the most peaceful states in the Middle Eastern area, the Middle East is now the most militarized region in the world. The latest news about the Hawk missiles going to Saudi Arabia, the United States being the chief arms trafficker and arms supplier in all the world, is not optimistic either. Arms buildups in Africa now create a new potential flashpoint too. So we need to realize that the nations of that part of the world called third world nations, underdeveloped, poverty-stricken for the most part, in the grips of severe economic crises, Egypt certainly a nation virtually on its knees economically in the wake of one devastating war after another. In my two visits there, in talking to officials, many of whom you heard on this series of programs, I also interviewed Egyptian President Anwar Sadat and the First Lady of Egypt's wife. Both of those interviews were on the telecast that many millions of people saw and heard. And I showed you that the nation of Egypt is in the grips of a severe economic crisis, that Sadat is having various emergency programs of this and that, where he's trying to expand the economy, trying to get that very aged and ancient economy of people off and running and to join the modern world in development. And yet, where is most of the money going? Well, to maintain a gigantic standing army for the weaponry, the modern military equipment necessary. You heard about the congressional action on the sale of 6C-130s, and I was talking about how we ought to be sending them tractors, and we ought to be sending them various implements of peace instead of the implements of the war of military-type equipment, which are vastly expensive anyway. But the arsenals being amassed by some of the Arab countries who simply can't spend their money fast enough, by the nations all around the area of Jerusalem in the Middle East, are very significant in the light of Bible prophecy. The Bible is a Middle Eastern book, remember. The Bible views the rest of the world from the perspective of Jerusalem in the land that used to be called the Palestine, a word that really came from ancient Philistine or Philistia, and from the present-day nation of Israel. According to the most important prophecy in all the Bible, the pivotal one really, of the most important prophet of all the Bible, who was Jesus Christ of Nazareth, and what he said in Matthew's 24th chapter is pivotal to all of the rest of prophecy in the Bible. The book of Daniel, the book of Revelation, could not have been correlated and understood without what he said in Matthew the 24th chapter. In that chapter, he gave a step-by-step sequence of events which would develop in what he called the time of the end. Now, I don't believe in the end of the world. Anyone who believes Bible prophecy could not believe in the end of the world. The Bible doesn't talk about the end of the world. People don't seem to realize the word world in ancient Greek at that time was either the word aeon, meaning age, or cosmos, meaning orderly system and society. It is true that orderly societies come to an end, sometimes through natural calamities and catastrophes, sometimes through warfare, sometimes some internal causes or a collection of many of those other causes. Empires have toppled, city-states have disappeared, nations have been subjugated, have gone down and out in the grips of famine and drought. Various civilizations have simply gradually disappeared under the sands of the Sahara or under huge landslides in the mountain areas. And when the Bible speaks of a catastrophic changing from the world which now is into the world which shall be. When it talks about the end of an age, it is speaking of a transitional age and the emerging of a new and a completely different age, a different world. Many people who hear the bad news before they stay around long enough to hear the good news tend to think that anyone who preaches Bible prophecy, especially out of the statements of Jesus Christ in Matthew 24, of how he said there should be wars and rumors of wars, there will be droughts and there is, there should be famine and there is, and how these things were to greatly intensify, the one overlapping the other, coming along on the heels of the other, to complement, if that's the word he used, the other, until eventually the world would be rocking and reeling in the grip of global warfare, a nuclear bomb, World War III, out of which would emerge a new and a completely different system of government on this earth called the Kingdom of God, the government of God. Now, to most people, I suppose that's not good news. Jesus called it good news. The meaning of the word gospel is good news. The good news is that Christ is on a countdown from heaven, that there is a God, that Jesus is alive and at the right hand of the Father in heaven, that he has a program, as much as we've seen our successful landing on Mars, and we had a countdown to the precise seconds and so on, and even though it was a few seconds late, nevertheless, a fantastically successful expedition. So Jesus Christ has a timetable, and there is a sequence of events which must occur on this earth prior to his interruption of human affairs and human events. Now, most people don't look at that good news of seeing that a coming benevolent government of an eternal, all-wise creator God on this earth with the power of the universe, of the power of the divine super being who is God and the Son of God, and millions of those who will be born into the family of God, that could be good news. They simply want to believe, seemingly, in a cataclysm unimaginable in its consequences, which will erase all life from the surface of the earth. A lot of people believe and seem to try to find biblical substantiation for it in an idea of what they call the end of the world. Well, the end of the world, in those English words in the Bible, will always mean the end of the cosmos, meaning the orderly system or society of today, and it could mean the national area in which it is being addressed, such as some of the major prophecies of the Bible, and in Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and then Hosea, and Amos, and others, or it can mean the end of an age. In Matthew, the 24th chapter, when Jesus is talking about the end of the world, then shall the end come, in verse 14, speaking of the gospel, he does not mean the end of the physical universe, the end of the earth, the end of all life upon it. That is proved to you easily by merely looking at verse 21, where he said, then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world of this time, no, nor ever shall be, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. Then he goes on to say, but for the elect's sake, and the Bible describes who are those elect, those who are called of God and doing the work of God, and whom is the Spirit of God. He says, for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. So the message is he's trying to save human flesh. Human beings. Humanity. What is our greatest quest today? Well, it could be survival. That's really the most important business at hand today for this world, is survival. How to survive, how to keep on living, how to preserve society. Maybe we better change society before we lose it. But at any rate, that is exactly the way you could pattern what is happening in the world today. What are the greatest searches among governments, among bodies of scientists, among those who are the thinkers, the planners at various levels who have input into the highest corridors of government? If it is not perhaps number one today, how to feed the world. Number two, how to fuel the world. How to keep the world going in its industrial base, in its developing economy. And these are the critical needs of humankind. Energy, that's where it's at. The development of alternative energy sources. As scientists around the world are talking about geothermal energy, or they're talking about solar energy and the need to somehow bridge the gap in technology into maybe 10, 20 or more years, depending upon who you talk to, between the complete absence and the giving out, finally, of the somewhat limited reserves of fossil fuels, of coal and oil, and the development of other sources of energy. This is one of the great quests of humankind. developing of energy sources to keep mankind alive. How to feed the world. But have you heard about what's happening in Europe, in Britain, in the United States, in Canada, for that matter around the world, the terrible shortfall in the Soviet harvest? There's going to be a short grain crop, and yet at the very same time, that drought that I was talking about on in the early 70s, it was going to strike in the middle 70s, and I said it over and over again. Did many programs, spoke before various groups, spoke before a kind of a provincial fair up in Canada, where I talked about impending drought, talked before vast audiences in the spring of 1975, when we had that very wet spring when the farmers couldn't get into the fields in Iowa and Nebraska and Illinois and other areas because of vast flooding. Now we see that in Europe, they're baking in the grips of a tremendous drought, that about so long as they've been keeping records in Britain, for example, they've got a more than 250-year record breaker in drought in Britain, and it's putting people just about down and out. Now in my own home state at least by adoption for the last 20-some years is California, they're having a terrible drought, tremendous water shortages. That's going to do a lot of things, just like you could expect. It's going to drive food prices up. It's going to drive grain prices up. People with various permanent crops, such as orchards, trees that take 10, 20, 50 years to come to the point where people are making a living off the production of fruits or nuts or things of that nature. And those trees are beginning to die in the state of California because the deep well water is going down. And the surface water is not as available as it once was. The snowpack is simply not there. Now, why? Well, recently, I've been talking in a series of programs from time to time in the book of Jeremiah. I showed you how no scientist would ever make a correlation or a relation whatsoever between the policies of a nation and its foreign policy, especially the modern nation of the United States of America, and the affliction of drought. They would never make such a correlation. But the Bible makes that correlation. It talks of various accords, various pacts and treaties and agreements as being not unlike or analogous to adultery between a married couple. Israel is likened unto the wife, and God is likened unto the suitor and then the husband in the agreement which is known as the Old Covenant. It is called a marital or a marriage agreement. I am married unto you, God said. He said, I was an husband unto them. And then he says repeatedly, like a wife who would leave her husband, Israel has forsaken me. And on in those chapters in Jeremiah, you see that analogy given of turning the back on God, not following God's methods in life, not following or believing or practicing his laws and his principles, which would keep the nation free of crime, of juvenile delinquency and violence, which would keep the nation free of divorce, which would give us great blessings and benefits in our crops, in our physical health, in our mental security and peace of mind. All the blessings, all the benefits we want. What do you want? Well, you want good health, good sleep, excitement. You want opportunity and experience. You want happiness and joy. You want lots of friends. You want lots of money. God says, beautiful, you can have it all, but you've got to do it my way. You've got to get in harness and in harmony with the laws which will produce those very things that you want the most. And what man seems to say is, no, I want to break all the laws which will produce what I want, and then I want you, God, magically to give me what I want while I'm breaking the very laws which would produce it. So by analogy, in the Bible, in the Old Testament of the Bible, God always called having concourse with foreign allies, God's people, ancient Israel, speaking now historically. And believe it or not, those 10 tribes have been found, and those peoples that were removed from ancient Israel centuries and centuries before Christ, 718 through 721, from major invasions, removed hundreds of thousands of them from that land. And they never returned there. They began to wander. They were called strangers in James' epistle. They were called people who were scattered abroad. They were called the lost sheep. They left indelibly their footprints and their mark, their father's name, in many cases, in valleys and rivers and mountains and various strategic and important geophysical areas of the earth as they migrated here and there across into northwestern Europe, the British Isles, eventually the United States of America, and they've been found. So while I'm speaking of ancient history, when I talk about ancient Israel making pacts or treaties with Syria or Egypt or Assyria or Babylon or somewhere else, modernly, in the prophecies of Jeremiah and Ezekiel principally, who wrote of a future impending captivity coming upon Israel, and yet he was already a captive, and Israel had already been taken captive, and he was writing in a future tense specifically to our people today. So when I say by analogy, ancient Israel was called an adulteress when she had various concords with surrounding pagan nations. So, by the same token, are the modern descendants of those people doing the very same thing. God called it leaning on a fragile reed that would break and pierce the hand. Talking about hewing out cisterns that can hold no water. He talks about the parleys and the treaties between nations as being like a spider's web, devious, that can't cover you, can't protect you. He says they hatch plans that they look for, and they sit on them like an old hen sitting on a hen's egg. But lo and behold, something begins to peck, and it looks for the squawk, and there's an adder in it. That's in a chapter in the book of Isaiah about the plans of nations for peace. And instead of peace, we have war. Well, the most important part of this world for your attention and for you to watch and look at is in the Middle East. Because this 24th chapter of the book of Matthew talks about the Middle East, and it talks about those living in the area of Judea fleeing into the mountainous area when they see certain things happening. When Jesus was asked by his disciples during that day, "What will be the sign of your coming?" his answer transcends all of that time on down into modern doings, modern times today, clear on down from the history of Jesus' day and his ministry in 29, 30, 31 A.D., on down to the Middle Ages, into this modern jet space nuclear age. And the sign that he gave them was as follows. He said, "Take heed that no man deceive you." That's verse 4 of Matthew 24. Because, of course, people would try, because there would be every conceivable religious point of view, every conceivable political party, every various ideal, precept, creed, every platform, every program, every organization or approach to solve the problems of man imaginable, and Jesus knew it, and he predicted it, and he said there would be many false prophets and even false Christs, and they would be able to show great signs and wonders. Now, you know, most people are so gullible in that area that they would say that some person who comes along and says, "By the way, my name is Jesus." "Oh, yeah, you know, well, you got to look like Jesus." One thing I took exception to that I would think Jimmy Carter would have rebuked him for was a caricature which was widely published. If someone had penciled in a fake beard and a mustache, because everyone thinks that Jesus had a long, pointed, fake beard, and of course, it just seems to be that Jimmy Carter's initials are also J.C. And so, of course, the correlation between the two was rather obvious. And some jokester, I guess, had kind of penned in the false beard, the mustache, and only J.C. can save America was the kind of a slogan. So, well, I thought it was a little bit in poor taste and maybe approaching a little bit of sacrilege there. But at any rate, that is the way some people seem to approach the real Christ of the Bible. But, you know, when he talks about false Christ, he means a lot more than just some artist trying to characterize a political figure as being a potential savior of the country. He's talking about people who would actually make such claims. People who would claim to be a priest, a prophet, a preacher, an evangelist, a minister, a cleric of some kind, and others who would make even greater claims, who would claim to be the very Son of God. You know that one prophecy in the book of Thessalonians, 1 Thessalonians there, the fourth chapter, talks about someone actually sitting in the temple of God as if he were God, claiming that he is God, and actually having the power to produce miracles. Now, most people's way of thinking, if someone would come along with such an outrageous claim, they would say, "Well, fine, I don't believe you, but show me the proof. Now, if you can cause that table over there to float across the room, if you can cause fire to come down in my sight, As you can walk on water, you can produce some completely extraterrestrial, extra-physical phenomenon that science could never explain, then I'll believe you. This is how gullible most people are. They want to see a sign. You know, Jesus said that an evil generation seeks after a sign. People were constantly coming in and saying, what sign do you give us from heaven? They want to see something supernatural, something phenomenal, something that smacks of magic, that really excites them and inspires them and turns them on and makes them realize that there is more than just human power here. So if people can see something in the neighborhood or the area of a sign, some great unexplained phenomenon, they would just immediately say, well, this has got to be the genuine article. And yet the Bible warns in verse 23, of the same 24th chapter of Matthew, if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, here he is, this is him, ladies and gentlemen, may I present, you know, Jesus Christ, he says, believe it not, for there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that if it were possible, meaning it is not possible, they should deceive the very elect. And they're both called the very elect, and they are not able to be deceived by those signs. So Jesus said, the very first thing he warned in the series of signs that would show his coming was near, take heed that no man deceive you. Because he said in verse 5, many shall come in my name, not a few. Now they come in his name, not their own. They say, I come to you in the name of Jesus. They use the name of Jesus. They use his name so often sometimes it becomes a little bit monotonous and exhausting. And the Bible talks about vain repetition and not taking the name of the Lord thy God in vain. Sometimes I think a lot of people do that and are breaking one of the commandments simply through vain repetition and not even realizing it. I'm not saying they're doing it intentionally. I'm saying that they're doing it without realizing it. Perhaps they are deceived, perhaps not. But he said many, not a few, would come and say that Jesus is the Christ, and they would deceive them. The next statement he said, you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. Now, if there was any way, to characterize your daily headlines, it is certainly that of wars and rumors of wars today. So he said to his own disciples, see that you be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end of what? A little later on he talked about the end that shall come in verse 14. The end is not yet. Well, if you look at all the prophecies, and even this one in its culmination, you will see that he is concerned with saving human flesh alive. So he's not talking of the total destruction of the surface of the earth, as many people seem to believe. He's talking of the end of man's way on the earth, the end of an orderly, or sometimes very greatly disorderly, society in all the various nations of this earth. He said, nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famine. And there are, right now, famine beginning to strike all of humankind a great deal more. Now, in that connection, and in programs I've done in the past on those four horsemen of the apocalypse, those mysterious horsemen in the vision of John that seem to come galloping out of the blackness of space, the one on a white horse, the one on a pale horse, the one on a black horse, the one on a red horse, and they were all described in very great detail. Then you have to go back into the book of Daniel, and here into the 24th chapter of Matthew, and you have to understand those seals of the 6th chapter of Revelation, of those mysterious horsemen of the apocalypse, and you will find that they sit hand in glove with this prophecy of Jesus Christ in the 24th chapter of Matthew. We prepared a booklet on each one of those horsemen of the apocalypse, and the one I think you ought to write for right now because of what's happening right this minute in Britain, in Europe, in Canada, and in much of the western part of the growing belt, the corn, the wheat belt, the vegetable areas of the United States of America is terrible, gripping drought. It's going to drive the price of your foodstuff in the next month up as never before. It's going to mean shortfalls and shortages in some items, and that means less supply. It means more demand. That means higher prices. We're going to see that happen. That's going to affect, in turn, industry, because it'll affect jobs and demand for more wages to offset the higher prices, because those will always be passed along by the growers and then by the producers, the canners, the packagers, the shippers, the retailers, distributors, and all the rest of them to the consumer. So the individual is going to eventually suffer because there's no snowpack in California, and that person who may want to buy an orange, who may live in Iowa, is going to find that he's got to pay a lot more for them because of crop destruction. So he wants to buy some vegetables, and California is one of the chief suppliers in that Central Valley. A tremendous percentage, getting up toward about half of all the vegetable supplies for the whole United States of America, grown in one valley in California. So when drought begins to strike in that area, you need to know what to expect and what the future is going to hold. This one book is called Famine. It's the series on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, The Black Horse, and it's called Famine. It shows you that in the book of Revelation there is a disturbing vision of four fearsome horsemen, each of whom is a symbol of four major punishments to be inflicted upon mankind, and probably in the not-too-distant future. Each one represents a final end-of-time culmination of the major crises with which the world has been confronted for centuries. False religion, war, famine, and disease epidemic. And that is beginning to happen right now. I'm not talking about colds and flu, and I'm not talking about some of the more or less man-created diseases of our modern age. I'm speaking now of those diseases that come along with the pollution of surface waters, those diseases that come along because of the absolute inability of people through protein deficiencies and malnutrition to stave off some of the infectious waterborne and other type diseases that can wipe out whole segments of population. In ancient Europe and Britain, it was the Black Death, the bubonic plague. And did you know that in a couple of counties, people have been ordered out of the woods in California because the squirrels carry a type of flea that can actually spread bubonic plague? That it's beginning to emerge, at least you begin to wonder, is there any potential there for it getting into domestic pests and down into the cities and so on in this modern era? Well, this booklet is right out of the pages of Bible prophecy, out of the book of Revelation, of Daniel, and the prophecies of Christ himself. It's quite a biography, quite an area for additional study. It's thoroughly illustrated, showing the ever-widening hunger gap. It even gives you, right out of history, all the great famines of the past. It lets you take a look at the Sub-Sahara, what's happening in the third world countries, some of those that are simply unable to feed themselves, the great cost of feeding the poor in the world today, and the fact that the United States, because of an ominous shift in weather patterns around the world, is going to find itself unable to continually support the rest of starving mankind. Now here we have this focal prophecy of Matthew 24, where Jesus is saying, when you see armies surrounding Jerusalem, he said, when you see the abomination of desolation, there should be a great pagan occurrence in Jerusalem. Very likely there will actually be the construction or the beginning of the construction or the dedication of such construction of some type in the future, which will be done at the behest of a world religious leader. When you see those things, he said, then the people who actually live in that area were given the warning to simply try to get out with their lives because the Middle East is going to explode. Do you know that in some states right now, Middle Eastern nations have more advanced weapons than the nations which manufacture those weapons? Britain has agreed to equip Iran with tremendous numbers of tanks, for example. Saudi Arabia, Syria, Egypt, Jordan, all of those nations equipped with some of the most sophisticated modern weapons of France, the United States, and in some cases the Soviet, as well as Britain, have been able to provide. So the Middle East is an absolute powder keg, and at the same time you've got drought and famine beginning to grip the world. You need this booklet entitled Famine, and also the current number of the Plain Truth magazine with exciting articles, Nuclear Power, What Kind of a Bargain Is It, Fighting Fair in Love and Marriage, The Ubiquitous UFO, and Who is the Real Jesus. You can have those by return mail free of charge if you will dial the toll-free number 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. Or you can write to me, Garner Jett Armstrong, Pasadena, California, for your free copy. Until next time, this is Garner Jett Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Jett Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your request, along with the call letters of this station, to Garner Jett Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial the toll-free number, 800-423-4444.